Okay, thanks very much, Brian. Thank you very much to the organizers. I like my title. It's sizzling, right. My name is Mark Phillips. I've been in Chile for 30 years, and I'm currently at the Las Campanas Observatory, but spent many years, which I enjoyed, at Cerro Tololo. I wanted to get nostalgic, since this is Bob's day, and I got nostalgic about my first Type 1A paper, which was, believe it or not, 22 years ago. I wrote a paper on supernova 1986G in Centaurus A. I'm proud of this paper. It's one of my favorites, because there's several things that I accomplished. The first one is I believe, I may be wrong, but I believe this is the first CCD light curve of a Type 1A supernova, and it was a good one. And also, we got wonderful spectroscopic coverage. It also turned out this object was not like Type 1As were supposed to be, so it sort of set me on a path of trying to understand the diversity of Type 1As. And something that maybe I shouldn't be so proud of is I think this was the first time that the ASP, PASP, had taken a paper with almost 30 authors on it. which started a trend, I think. But the real reason for this nostalgia is I went and looked up the acknowledgments, and it says, if you can't read us, it says, special thanks to R. Kirshner, both for his encouragement during this project and for alerting us early on to the discovery of supernova 1986G. Also grateful to David Branch for critical comments on the draft and manuscript. And I wanted to thank Bob in front of everyone, because Bob was the guy who got me on this object and got me into this field. And so I have a special affection for you. Bob's one of the few people who see me in my pajamas. But I'm not going to go into that. OK, on to the CSP. CSP actually consists of two components. There's a low Z component and a high Z component. The low Z part, our goal was to obtain precision U to H light curves and spectrophotometry of roughly 100 type 1A supernovae out to a redshift of 0.07, roughly 100 type 2 supernovae, 0.05, and as many type 1B, 1Cs as we could do. It's a 5-year project, and we've now finished the observational part. The high Z part was we wanted to obtain, this was started 7 years ago. We still weren't quite confident of this dark energy result. And so we wanted to obtain a rest system I-band light curve for approximately 100 type 1As out to a redshift of 0.7. And I'm going to talk about the low Z component of this. But the overall science goals were to gain insight into the progenitors and explosion mechanisms through detailed photometry and as much spectrophotometry as we could get. Refining methods for determining distances with both type 1As and type 2s. We wanted to be part of the effort to provide a new fundamental reference for observations of high redshift supernovae. And the high Z part was to characterize dark energy by working in the I band where the extinction should be a much smaller factor to deal with. CSP was possible because of the access to telescope time we have at Las Campanas, particularly the small telescopes. And the real workhorse in the CSP was the SWOPE 1-meter telescope, first telescope to be constructed at Las Campanas. We did all of our optical photometry there, did most of our infrared photometry there. Did a little bit on, well, some on the DuPont and a very small amount on the Magellan telescopes. And our spectroscopy was done mostly with the DuPont 2.5 meter, some time on the Magellan telescopes, and then we had some time at Tololo and at ESO. The CSP has its roots in the Kalan-Tololo collaboration. It's not coincidental that Nick, Mario, and I are all played a prominent role in getting this going. We sort of saw it as the follow-up to Kalan-Tololo, which we were fortunate enough to be part of. But it's involved a lot of people. Wendy Friedman has been leading the high redshift part. There's a bunch of people in Chile, a number of people in Pasadena, and then there's the Texas consortium here. And then we have a number of important collaborators. This is just a very brief list here. That does not include everyone. But I'd certainly like to point out Alex and Weidong Li, who very kindly moved their LOSS survey towards more southern latitudes so that we could have more targets to be following. And I'd like to recognize Max Stritzinger, who is here in the first row here, who is our present postdoc, Gaston Falatelli, who was our former postdoc, and of course Nick, who's here as well. So we have some recent papers out. This one's actually on the Los Alamos server. This is the high redshift, first high redshift result, which is, has about half of our total number of supernovae. We did about 70. We wanted to get 100. We were able to get about 70. And then we have two papers on the low redshift results, a data paper and an analysis paper. This paper, there's a poster out here, which you might want to stop by and see. And these are in the process of being, we're responding to the referee. We're hoping to have them on the server sometime like next week. The authors of these paper, I wanted to put big pictures of them, Carlos Contreras and Gaston Falatelli. Gaston's here. This is Gaston sailing out in the Channel Islands. And this is Carlos in my house. And Carlos is currently pursuing a PhD at Swinburne. He's a really sharp guy. I hope he comes back to the supernova field. And Gaston is, of course, here and done a great job with us. So these are the passbands we've been observing with. Six optical passbands, Sloan UGRI and Standard Johnson BV. In the infrared, we've concentrated on the Y band, J band, H band. We've gotten a few observations in K, but it's mostly YJH. We're planning to precisely measure the CSP passbands using an apparatus that Nick and his colleagues are putting together, and this will take place in January of 2010. We're certainly encouraging everybody that's in this game to do the same thing. I don't normally give talks where I show color term coefficients, but I just wanted to show you this. This is over a four-year period. We actually have a fifth year here, but I haven't plotted it yet. And you can see the stability of the color terms here for the optical photometry, which is very, very important. You really want a stable photometric system when you're doing this. And extinction coefficients. This is the first time I've ever shown extinction coefficients in a talk. But I want you to notice how rock steady these are. Las Campanas is a photometric site, and that's what you want. Two out of every three nights that we observed were photometric. So our expectation was roughly 100 type 1As and type 2s, and we were hoping for 25 of the 1B, 1C, 2Bs. And you can see we did quite well, 129, 93, 31, 253 total. These are where the supernovae came from. The LOSS survey was certainly our big source of these. And many of these were caught quite early. But there's also a number of other groups. We did several of the SDSS, the Sloan supernovae, to try to get overlap to be able to compare our systems. This is the redshift distribution of the supernovae. And you can see that it peaks for the type 1As somewhere around 0.03. The median must be around 0.03 or so. And type 2 is, of course, a little bit closer. And the type 1B, 1Cs. Examples of light curves. I've got three slides. This is sort of the good ones, the really good ones, caught quite early, and where we got very good infrared coverage. This is sort of more typical of about two-thirds of the sample, where we started here just before maximum, started here right at maximum. This one, we got pretty good infrared coverage. This one, a little bit less. You can see it's tough to get this maximum in the infrared because it occurs about 5 days before the B maximum. And then about a third of the objects, you know, you do what you can. And this is these are fairly representative. Here we've started observing a few days after maximum. We did get infrared coverage. It's out at redshift 0.05. SWOP telescope has a tougher time at that redshift, but we still got decent photometry. This is an example of sort of the worst ones in our sample, 2005 LU, where we were a week or so after maximum, but we observed it because we had time. So I wanted to spend the rest of the talk just talking about aspects of the CSP data that interest me, and that these are things that are mostly in our paper, the Folatelli et al. Paper. First thing is the secondary maximum, which is one of the distinguishing features of type 1As in the I band J, H, and K. This is from a paper by Dan Kaysen, a really nice paper, 2006, where he pointed out that the timing and strength of the secondary maximum is predicted to be primarily a function of nickel, 56, which means it should be a function of the decline rate. And in fact, the timing one had been seen before. These were the relationships which Dan predicted. Now, you have to do a mirror flip here, because this is increasing nickel here. This is increasing nickel in this direction. You can see in the top one, which has the time between the second maximum and the time of blue maximum, we see a very nice relationship with CSP supernova, very similar to what was predicted by Dan. But these other two, which is, this is the magnitude difference between the secondary peak of the secondary maximum and the dip between the two maxima, and this is the difference between the secondary maximum and the primary maximum, we don't see such a nice relationship there. However, there are other ways to measure the strength of the secondary maximum. And Kevin Christianis came up with what I think is quite a useful one. And the way you do it is you simply, this is done for the I band here, you take and you turn the light curve into flux points, and you simply integrate the flux, normalize it to 1 at maximum, and you integrate the flux from 20 to 40 days after B maximum. When you do that, you plot this I 2040 as a function of decline rate, you get a very nice relationship. So yes, there is a very good relationship between the strength of the maximum and the amount of nickel 56th, strength of the secondary maximum. But there are some outliers here, you can see. This was back in 2001. And this is this relationship again. And here are actual light curves of these. And you can tell these objects are clearly different. They're almost identical, in both cases, in B and V, which means they have the same decline rates. But they have quite different strengths of the secondary maximum. So we've done the same plot for the CSP data. And this is this I 2040. This is little I now, small I. And this is the decline rate. And we see a relationship here. This line is actually a line we get from the templates we use. It should be sort of the average value. And you can see this scatter here. I chose these four supernovae, which all have essentially the same decline rate, and plotted their light curves on this side. And again, you can see B and V are smack dab right on top of each other, which is the way they should be, because that's how we measure the decline rate, really. But you can see the variations in the secondary maximum. I think this is important. And I think it's something that will be fun for the theorists to work on. Actually, Dan's paper and some work that Peter Hoflich did quite a few years ago, variations in secondary maximum can be understood. It's possible it's due to mixing. It's possible perhaps to metallicity. I'm wondering if there may be a geometrical effect as well, just from the way you're looking at it in line of sight. And a really interesting question to pursue, I don't know what the answer is could the strength of the maximum be a parameter for reducing the dispersion that still exists in type 1As? I don't know. Once we get a good sample, it'll be interesting to look at it. Okay, on to my obsession for the last 10 years, which is reddening. And you can try to measure color excesses for these supernovae. We have to assume something about their colors, their intrinsic colors. And we did something that repeated basically something we did in 1999, where we used the Lyra relationship, where low reddened supernovae follow a pretty nice trend here from roughly 30 to 90 days after maximum. And one can identify a subsample which you believe to be low reddened, ones that are in early type galaxies, ones that are in spirals way outside of spiral arms. And we did that, came up with this group of objects. We get a dispersion here around 0.08 magnitudes here, although you'll notice that the supernovae are systematically different from this. So dispersion is, dispersion is not just random. It's mostly, in fact, systematic. But you can use these then to then measure colors at maximum. This is a pseudocolor maximum. So it's the B maximum magnitude minus the V maximum magnitude, or other colors, G minus R, V minus I, V minus Y. The blue objects are this little reddened sample. And you can see they form an I sequence. You can fit relation to that. So you can measure color excesses either with this or using the colors at maximum. And one of the disturbing things we found, if we actually take the difference between these color excesses, what was measured with the Lira relationship minus those measured at maximum, plot it as a function of the color excess at maximum, you actually see what looks to be a relationship here. Now, the error bars are big, so you know maybe it's just rotten luck. But we went back, since we'd done the same thing in 1989, I went back and looked at the 1999 data, and the same relationship is there. It also seems to be a function, the difference of these color excesses seems to be a function of B minus V at maximum. It does not seem to be a function of decline rate, maybe slight trend with a corrected absolute magnitude. So how can this be? Well, I think either a component of one of these other color excesses is not due to dust. I don't understand that. It means there has to be some intrinsic dispersion that's there in either maximum or in the tail, but which is not in the other. Or, even more bizarre, we're somehow seeing evidence for time variable extinction, which maybe we would just want to leave that one right here. That wouldn't be good. Okay, you can also use the ratios of the color excesses. So we have that little caveat of that problem here, but let's use the color excesses at maximum. You can take ratios of those. So this is V minus I versus EB minus V. This is V minus J versus EB minus V. And you can look at the reddening law. And you can see that there's two objects here which fit fairly nicely on RV of around 1.7. These are 06X, 05A. These are the color excesses plotted as a function of 1 over lambda. And in fact, we find that the best fitting model actually is this Wang-Gubar dust scattering model, which Gubar has parameterized, basically a power law. The thing that's pushing us towards that is the U-band. So an interesting result, suggesting that these low values of RV in these very heavy reddened objects may be due to scattering. But what about the low reddening objects? Well, if you sort of stand back there and look at it, they don't really seem to follow this line here. There's a few objects. We need more. But in fact, if you take the average, they come out at about 3.2. So maybe we're seeing actual reddening here. That's interesting, reddening like we see in the Milky Way. On the other hand, when we use exactly these same color excesses and do what everybody else does, which is leave RV as a free parameter, minimize this equation, which is essentially equivalent to minimizing Hubble diagram dispersion, we get an RV of 1.5. So if you minimize the dispersion in the Hubble diagram, you get a low value of RV. If you take color excess ratios, they look more like normal reddening. So as Mark was saying yesterday, maybe we have a mixture here of intrinsic color variations, normal reddening of dust, maybe funny reddening of dust due to circumstellar material. I don't know what's going on. Near-infrared light curves. I'll go quick. So this is another graph from Dan's paper. This is a graph we've made of showing all of our data. Thank you. Plotted on absolute magnitudes. I-band, Y-band, J-band, H-band. You can see that the J-band, they're beautiful. There's a very small dispersion, except for these objects here, which are the 91BG-like objects, which actually peak later. This is a delta M15 versus the absolute magnitude corrected for a reddening, which is very small. And you can see here that absolute magnitudes are almost flat over the decline rates out to about 1.7. Maybe there's a very slight slope here. We need more objects to really determine that. Another interesting thing is just doing a Hubble diagram. Our objects are fairly nearby, so we see a lot of scatter, particularly in the nearby ones. Obviously, due to peculiar velocities, this is what we'd expect due to 300 kilometers per second. These are dispersions we get in the individual Hubble diagrams. When we combine them all, we only get a dispersion of 0.11. So we don't really decrease this dispersion significantly. And this is because if you take the residuals in the Hubble diagrams, the residual in U plotted versus the residual in B, G, R, I, Y, J, you can see there's a clear correlation in the residuals. And we've looked at this. It's like there's some gray thing there, okay, that's affecting all of the colors the same way. Well, that gray thing is probably peculiar velocities. And if you take that out, it means that we're actually measuring distances to around 3 to 4%. And this is consistent with what Mark was saying yesterday. So do I have time to do this last little thing here? Okay. Something I've always been intrigued by is this transition from normal type 1As to the 91BG-like events. This is the luminosity decline rate relationship. You see this linear part here, the 91BG objects, and then there's this sort of wasteland where there's only a few objects. Well, we have a few. They're in that. This is on the sort of left edge of that diagram. This is on the right edge. And I've plotted the B and V Likers here. You can measure the delta M15s very clearly. And these are the numbers you get. If we just sort of show more of the light curve, you can just sort of look at the general shapes of the light curves. And the one that sort of sticks out is in the B diagram, is 2005 KE. But then we can look at the I band. And we see that three of them have secondary maxima. But again, 2005 KE does not. It actually peaks after B maximum. And the others peak before B maximum. Spectroscopically, there's actually a sequence here. 05 KE shows very strong titanium 2, which is typical of 91BG-like objects. You can see a little bit of it in GT, but not really in these other two. Then we can do bolometric light curves. And again, three of them hang right together. But one of them is lower luminosity, and that's 05 KE. So 05 KE, it seems to be the oddball here. Go back to this diagram here, where you notice all of these supernovae that hang together, but then there are these ones that are the 91BG-like objects, which are lower luminosity and occurring later. And so I would like to suggest, and other people have suggested this, that we've actually got two types of supernovae here. We've got the extension of the normal type 1As to the highest decline rates, the lowest amounts of nickel. Plus, we also have these 91BG objects, which are sort of in this area. So we may actually be seeing two different types of supernovae. And that's it. I did good. I want to keep my knees. They're not doing very well. So I wanted to make an announcement. We just got word a couple days ago that there's going to be an Aspen workshop on type 1A supernovae on the weeks of August 8 and August 15, 2010. Put it down in your calendars. And we're just going to get there and groove on, that's a 60s word, on type 1As.
All right, Peter. OK, I want to make two comments for 91BG-like. At least what we found already in 95 and a little bit later,
right.
That basically if you make it less subluminous, secondary maximum becomes earlier and earlier. And eventually, 91BG-like objects, the two maxima merge. And therefore, what we see is not the primary maximum and the secondary maximum separately, but it's just the merging scenario.
Right.
The other argument was actually, which I want to make for supplements one, what we showed in 2001 was actually that they can be understood in the same class of Chandrasekhar mass objects, but just you produce, because you have a larger pre-expansion, more silicon on the expense of nickel. So the mass is the same, but you suddenly have a very broad silicon line. And if you analyze the spectra, it's possible really to see the white silicon line
right.
And the large number. So they may not be separate objects, but they may just be a continuation.
I guess my response to that, I'm willing to believe that it's one trend, but my response to that is I don't see something in between these and these. When I look for them, they're either these or these. So if I could find something that just sort of merges these two groups together, then I would agree. But We don't see that yet.
Now, we have two supernovae in the beginning of the 90s, which seemed to fill the gap between 86G and 91BG-like. But the parameters to make it from normal bright to very supplement bright is very steep. You just fall down a hill, basically, because the opacity suddenly is, you are so cool at the maximum light that you just release the energy very fast. So it's a very fast transition at about 0.1 solar masses of nickel, and if you go to 0.04.
Yes.
But just as a comment.
Yes, I appreciate that this is an area where things are changing very quickly.
Yes.
Temperature, slight changes in temperature, changing opacity. So maybe that's still what's going on. But I think it's also interesting to consider the possibility that they're separate.
This is the question opposite of diversity. Is there something like the most normal 1A? And how would you define it? And do you see them in your sample?
Yeah, I think basically all these objects in here, maybe until you get out to the slow decliners, I think they're all what I call normal. But within that normality, as I showed, we see variations in the secondary maximum, okay? And probably in other features. Well, certainly in velocities, there's some differences. So I consider all of these to be normal. They're the ones we use to determine distances. We're determining distances to 3 to 4%. I mean, come on, that's pretty good. But the point I'm trying to make as well is, if you look closely, within that normality, there is diversity, which is good.
Mark, you were showing the scatter you get in different past bands.
Right.
And it went by fast, but it looked to me like you were doing best in J. There was a paper by Casey Mandel saying maybe you would do best in H, although maybe that's consistent here, I don't know.
Yeah.
It kind of does look like J does better than Y or H, but
yeah.
Can you say something about why you think, is it?
I don't necessarily believe the differences here,
okay,
is what I would say. And I think that we're still being limited by these variations in the secondary maximum.
Yeah.
What I didn't say is those variations play hell on tempo fitting.
Yeah.
And particularly in the near infrared, where it's hard to catch these things at maximum, you're being jerked around by that secondary maximum. And so I actually believe that some of this dispersion, I'm sure that some of this dispersion is just due to template fitting. And so we got to come up with a better way. This is one of the things that we're working on. Maybe not try to measure the maximum magnitude. Maybe try to measure some of the maximum. So I think that it's very likely that we can actually get these dispersions down. And as to which band is going to be better, I don't think we know yet.
Well, this is just great stuff, and it's really interesting to see. And I just want to threaten people with the fact that at the very end of the day, when I'm going to give the talk, it'll be exactly on these same issues, where Casey Mandel has taken a good look at the infrared data that we have and combined it with
right.
Optical photometry that Alan did, and it explores some of these same questions. And so that's something you cannot escape from the fact that if dust, then the possibility of a combination of dust and intrinsic variation in the properties of the supernovae, that is the most difficult systematic problem, and that is the limit on how well we can predict the theory of those supernovae.
I thought what you found about reddening and absorption being variable was very intriguing.
Oh, no.
And
I said maybe we ought to just leave that right here.
Well, I guess I have a question from the theoretical perspective. When you're working on the progenitor models, you're trying to understand how much matter is ejected by this system over time and to what mechanisms. So I'm just wondering if what you see would be consistent with there being a lot of material close to the close to the supernova, that the light has to travel through at early times, and then later on, of course, the supernova itself has expanded, and so you're only seeing
I've gone through phases where I've thought that was the case, but then I've gone through phases where I've been convinced that it's not. I think that the kind of observations that Nando's doing, I'm also trying to do the same thing. We're collaborating on some objects where you look at the variability of the interstellar lines with time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's going to give us a better idea of how many of these objects actually have some significant amount of material around them. Of course, mm-hmm. it could be concentrated in a plane, so maybe they've all got some. But it's a possibility.
I think that would really be very important for, because the, one of the areas that we've made very little progress on is in figuring out exactly what the progenitors are in terms of what type of system they are.
Right.
And this could really be a crucial type of information that maybe eventually could then feed back and, you know, correct for the effect. But we might be able to understand it much better through exactly this type of work and the work that Nando is doing.
Right.
All right. Let's thank Mark.
One's next. It's number